Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news from the past month. This is episode number 59 for September 2015. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we get together from different people from different countries, different culture, and we talk about what's been happening in the past couple of, well, the past month, really. And we try to get different perspectives on the same story, so we kind of learn how other people think about the things that we think we've got completely figured out. Hopefully, we'll manage to do a little bit of that today. My name is Patrick Beja. I'm from France, and I am joined by two returning guests. One is, I'm going to start with the one closest to me physically, I'm guessing, Pierre or Piotr or Pierre from Russia. How's it going, Pierre?
Hey, it's going quite fine. It's a beautiful sunset here.
So you told me you just came back from your vacation. Where do Russian people go for vacation?
Since the ruble is so cheap, it's much more popular to
stay in Russia.
Well, mostly, or go to countries that accept rubles as payment.
Oh, do the former Union countries still accept rubles? Oh.
Not all of them. Well, none of them, actually. but the unrecognized republics of Abkhazia and Southern Ossetia do.
I see. All right. So you were staying within the, how do you call it, the zone of influence of Russia, I guess.
I guess they call it that. Georgians still think we occupy that place.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So thank you for being back on the show. And we also have a good friend of mine who's returning after years of absence. But I figured it was time that we got a conservative voice on the show, because we're always liberals on this show, including Americans. They're mostly to the left side of the aisle. So I figured now was the time to have a real strong American Eagle conservative voice. And so I called Brian. How's it going,
Brian? A
real
American, you mean, yeah. So.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm excellent. Very glad to have you on the show. I hope you will excuse my characterization of your political opinions, but you are more of a conservative, right? You're confirming this.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
I will prove this beyond any shadow of a doubt to anyone listening, because I can tell them that when I got in the U.S., maybe the third or fourth time, you were there. It was for the Nerdtacular convention a few years ago, and you took me to a shooting range. And I think if that doesn't prove that you are a conservative person, then nothing will. And we went shooting and everything. I was terrified, but I did it. Very proud of myself. So there you go.
You were terrified. Oh, you did a good job. I thought you did a great job. You and Terpster, you were ready to fight the zombies. That was for sure.
that was basically our zombie training. And we did okay. I mean, if those paper targets had been zombies, they would have been like completely dead. So
definitely. You were both giving Rick a run for his money. So,
Well, thank you for being on the show. We're going to be covering a bunch of things today. First of all, I want to talk about the migrant situation in Europe again, but I'm not going to talk too much. I'm going to give you guys an opportunity to tell us how it's been regarded in your countries, because we've talked about it so much last episode. I don't want to go over all of this again. We're also going to be talking about the Republican candidates. And hopefully, Brian, you can explain the mystery that is Donald Trump to us. And maybe we're going to be talking about Hillary as well. And Piotr, should I call you Peter or Pierre or Piotr? I'm not sure.
Call me whatever. Well, I guess it's more easy for you to call me Pierre.
Okay, well, we'll go with Pierre then. Sorry, because, yeah, you have two names, actually, or something, because your official name is Piotr, because you weren't really, it wasn't very easy for you to be called Pierre because of War and Peace and everything back then. That's how you told me, right?
Yes, sort of.
Sort of, okay. Okay, all right. I thought you were going to explain. Never mind.
Well, I can explain if it is required. There was a criminal offense in Soviet Russia called bowing before the West and giving children Western names was sort of in it.
Ah, so that's why, even though you were named after... right, and okay, I see. That's interesting, actually. I didn't quite understand that when you first explained it to me. I think we might need to do an entire episode on Soviet Russia at some point. I think that might be interesting. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the special episodes at the end of this one, because I want to start doing things with that concept with this show. I'm going to try and develop it a little bit further, but I'll talk about that later. And Pierre, you were saying that you wanted to talk about Syria, and certainly there is some debate about Russia's involvement there, so I think it's going to be interesting as well. But first, linked to Syria, but not exactly that, the migrants crisis in Europe is still very much happening. And I guess the thing that happened since last time was that Angela Merkel in Germany said, we have to be humane and we have to open the borders. And it doesn't matter how much, you know, how many people are there. We just have to do it because it's our duty as people. And she was applauded everywhere in Europe. And she was basically showing the way, according to a lot of journalists, and showing how Europe should behave, and what we had been doing until now was shameful. And I think she raised a lot of enthusiasm for being more generous with our welcoming of those refugees. And the terrible thing was that basically a week later, she had to close down the borders, putting it in jeopardy, not in jeopardy, but basically in spite of the Schengen accords, which say that there are no borders within basically Europe, within the Schengen zone. And she had to close the borders because there were too many refugees showing up in Germany and they didn't have enough infrastructure to accommodate them. So that was sort of an emotional humanitarian roller coaster. And the result is that we still don't really know how to deal with that issue. There are still people who are saying, we should be more compassionate in the way we approach the issue. And there are still people who say, well, sure, but how do we do it? And there are people who are like, well, you know, this is unacceptable. We don't have enough bread to feed our own people. I'm paraphrasing, but you see the kind of speech and discourse this might become. So yeah, things haven't changed all that much after the roller coaster I was talking about earlier. So I'm curious to hear, rather than discuss this from the European point of view again, to hear what you guys have been hearing about it in the media, in the maybe in, you know, your everyday discussions with your friends. Is it discussed at all? How is it seen? Let's start with Brian, maybe.
Okay. It's seen as, I'm personally, I'm a little surprised with Angela Merkel taking that kind of stance. You know, I was stationed in Germany for 3 years, and they had Turks that were there for many years, and they weren't very well accepted when I was there. So I was really kind of surprised how Angela Merkel did that turnaround, and I'm going to be surprised if the German people overall are going to maintain that warm reception for the years to come.
Well, they already closed the border, so I don't know how warm it's going to be. I think there was a little bit of guilt over World War II. It was kind of a redemption play, genuine, I think. But also, there's a very, I guess that's a good point. There's a very different sentiment towards not refugees, but migrants, you know, immigrants. Rather than immigrants in general in Europe, and refugees, because there is, you know, obviously there when you're a war refugee, your status is a lot different than if you're just, you know, things are fine in your country and you're coming in and going in another country. Usually illegally is the situation that gets people fired up. Was that discussed at all in the U.S.? Is it a topic of conversation, or is it just too far away and people don't care?
No, it's been very well discussed. You know, I read the Wall Street Journal every day, and it's in there every day. There's always something about the refugees, and I think we always have to make the distinction between migrants and the refugees. There is a difference in those, and the big thing with John Kerry, our Secretary of State, has indicated they're going to increase the number of refugees the U.S. will take in over the next few years up to 100,000. And some people have gotten concerned about that, but it's mostly from not that we can't take that many people in, as more to do with the security questions about who we are letting in. You know, are they actually refugees? Or are they migrants? That kind of thing. That the security question's the number one concern. Not, I don't think is as much, you know, some people raise the amount of people, but when you look back in history, when we had the Vietnamese boat people, you know, the U.S. took in over 400,000 of those refugees. So I don't think it's the numbers. It's really got to be about the security right now.
I think there's a lot of that as well in Europe, where people are concerned about the numbers, but really everything that, you know, every serious if you look at the question seriously, it shouldn't be an issue. But who are we letting in is also kind of a question being raised in some circles. I think it's a little bit of a red herring. It's kind of if basically terrorists is the worry, right, Brian? I'm guessing
that'd be correct. I think that, you know, they say it's a lot of young men or a lot of men that are being the ones that are coming across. And, you know, I'd be less concerned about someone when, you know, a guy with his family, you know, got a wife and kids, you know. But when you start having all these single guys, of course, then how are you going to vet them? How do you know they're Syrian? How do you know there's genuine security questions involved with it. It's just that, like I said, then you have to separate refugees from the migrants.
I guess the thing is, when you let that many people in, of course there are going to be some people who are going to take advantage of this, but first of all, there is no way to avoid this. So if that is a big enough concern, then I'm guessing you should just not let it. It's not a reason to not let anyone in, right? And
correct.
And if those people are your concern, aren't they going to be able to get in anyway somehow? I would think. I don't know. The concern is happening.
Well, I think it's more of a concern in Europe. I mean, it's less so for the States, I would think, because, I mean, they could get in. You know, it is possible they could come in illegally, I guess, you know, but it's, you know, it's a lot tougher for them to do that.
It's the same in France. They can come in illegally anyway. So, Pierre, what about you guys? Are you concerned about this at all?
The most common opinion about in the public about it is a bit of Schadenfreude.
Explain, please.
well, It's happiness at the misfortune of others.
Okay. That is disturbing, but please go ahead.
Well, to put it simple, Europe in general wasn't too kind towards Russia in the last couple of years, or maybe last couple of centuries. So when something bad happens to you guys, most people think you've had it coming.
Ah, I see. Like, is it like a genuine, you know, that serves you right? Or is it more of a, well, that's not surprising. Is it like, is there anger in that sentiment? I'm wondering. Or is it just shrugging?
It depends on the people who say it. A bit of both, I guess.
Okay. And are you guys discussing the possibility of getting refugees in the country, or is that not even considered?
We are getting some refugees to the country. We are quite suited for that. We accepted many refugees from Donetsk and Lugansk last year. Rostov region was full of them,
right,
actually.
Right.
Many of them now returned back. Many didn't. So, well, we accept those who come, but we do not offer much, so I guess nobody comes.
You know, that's actually something that happened with France. At some point, we did open the border. Well, not open the borders, but said we would welcome more people. And there was a couple of articles saying, actually, they don't want to come. They want to go to the UK, they want to go to Germany, but in France, the rumors and the common knowledge is that administratively it's so complicated that people just don't want to come. They're like, you know, there are ridiculous issues, like in order to get your war refugee status, you need an address, but in order to get an address, you need your war refugee status. And it's a bunch of things like that that make it so difficult for people to figure things out that they don't even want to come. There was like they were going to welcome a few thousand people and they only found 600 willing to come to France from Germany. It was like, what is happening? But yeah, so I'm kind of I don't know if I'm ashamed or embarrassed for France in that respect, but it's definitely a head-scratching moment when you're like, yeah, it's all right, you guys have had a horrible life and you're, you know, running away from war, come here and we'll take care of you. And they're like, nah, it's fine, we'll stay in the overcrowded camps in Germany. Well, we're good, thank you. No, thank you, but no thank you. You're like, huh, okay. We're going to go back and play.
Well, it is fest season in Germany right now, so why would you leave?
I guess so. Although most of them are Muslims and probably not drinking, so. But
yeah, sure. Okay.
It is accented in our media that quite many of those people are actually illegal migrants and not refugees. We had a reporter from some newspaper who bought Syrian passport in Syria for something like $800. And went all the way to Europe, to Switzerland, I guess, to become a registered refugee.
Well, it's interesting that the media would accentuate that story because obviously it's possible. I don't think anyone is saying it isn't. I'm not sure, however, how many people would choose to do that in the, you know, how the percentage of those people that are in that situation, given there's a lot of examining of our own guilt in the process, and you know, to an extent, the Iraq war is being brought up here and there, but not just because of the American involvement, although it was, you know, obviously the most biggest part of it, but because of all of our involvement and the fact that we went there and, you know, messed things up and left. And I'm wondering if in that is what created the mess that has resulted in the situation the region is currently in. I'm wondering if that comes up at all in the U.S. when talking about the crisis, Brian.
Oh, definitely. That it's an old thing that keeps coming up. Well, this wouldn't be happening if the U.S. never invaded Iraq. And it's, you know, you're kind of like, well, there was an actual genuine revolution or uprising against Assad in Syria. I mean, he has been the old guard. I mean, he's not much better than his father was, you know.
Sure.
Bashar Assad and it's funny what I find interesting about Syria is that, you know, all the other countries, and like you look at the 68 war, 72 war with Israel, you know, all the other countries except for Syria have basically kind of made peace with Israel, except for Syria. Syria has been holding the same hard line that they have been.
And Iran. But you know, the thing that we're usually saying isn't in regards to that. It's not like, oh, we shouldn't have gone in. It's more of a, well, we did go in, but then the big mistake was that we left. And that's kind of surprising. It's like, well, when we left, the country wasn't stable. So we really should have stayed longer, but we didn't because it was an unpopular situation. And politically, it was difficult to justify it. So
that's what a lot of people, like including myself, say. There should have been a status. They call it the status of forces agreement. Should have been made with Iraq, and had a couple bases there for the U.S. forces and air forces, land forces and air forces, because Assad was getting supplies and troops from flown from Iran, and they were flying over Iraq, and Iraq really couldn't really do anything about it. But if we had had a base there, you know, we could have nipped it in the bud. They could have done air operations, reinforced Iraqi troops, town, you know, giving them so the support they would have needed to take out ISIS before it became too big and got out of hand, which is what has happened.
I think that the next issue now that is that people are talking about, with the immediate issue, is definitely the refugees, and the secondary issue, which should be the primary one, is what are we going to do about ISIS? Because obviously they're being displaced because of the wars happening in the region, and a lot of people are arguing that we should just stop the the politician bullshit, and just we need strikes, at a minimum airstrikes, to counterattack the ISIS actions. So I don't know if it's actually going to happen, but at that point it's getting to the very much to the forefront of the discussions, which brings me, before we move on to the Republican candidates mystery in the U.S., brings me to the topic that, Pierre, you wanted to cover, which is Russia's involvement in Syria, which is kind of a... Let me tell you how it's being viewed from here. It's basically satellites and reports are Russia is moving in Syria, and Russia's official response is... we don't know what you're talking about. Everything's normal in Syria. So, yeah, nothing to report. So I'm curious how it's being, you know, discussed in the country.
Yeah, there's an old song from a Russian movie about Aladdin with the catchphrase, there's everything calm in Baghdad.
Okay, everything's calm in Baghdad?
Yeah, everything's calm in Baghdad. The official position of Russia is that we only supply Assad with military instructors and weaponry.
So no troops
That is the official position. I've no doubt that there might be some volunteers from...
I like the term volunteers.
I do not think they are being volunteered. Well, most of them.
So you think they're genuine volunteers who want to go? So why would they go, though? I'm guessing it's not to support the Syrian regime. It's more to fight ISIS, which is getting out of hand.
Yes, it is more to fight ISIS. Russia is a historically Orthodox country, Christian Orthodox. Later, after we were invaded by Tatars and stuff, we had to accept Muslims in between us, but religious tension still exists. Some take it fine, some take it calmly, but of course there are many religious radicals, and I guess fighting ISIS abroad would actually be a morally acceptable and fine way for them to use their zealotry for good.
I'm not sure I get it.
They are Christians.
You mean the people who volunteer to go on?
I guess it is one of the most popular reasons. There must be Christians who hate Muslims but have no legal rights to go against them except verbally in their own country.
Oh, wow. So you actually think those going to fight in Syria are basically religious zealots, is what you're saying?
Yeah, they might be. Mm. Volunteers, at least, it's the most common cause. Also, there might be people who have suffered from previous terror acts in Moscow. All of them have been done by Muslims or said to be done by Muslims.
Right. So basically they're going to fight terrorism.
Well, yeah, terrorism and Islam. Many people think Islam is getting out of hand. Well,
wow.
Radical Islam, that is. The official position of the country is, of course, towards the religious tolerance and stuff like that. Just this week, Putin have opened the Europe's greatest mosque in Moscow. Many Muslims from all over the Russia and abroad came there. All the center of Moscow has been closed. Nobody could get to work because of that. There were policemen every 2 meters of the roads. All the subway, many of the subway stations were closed. So
it's not an institutionalized stance against Islam. It's portions of the population that are extreme in their views of Islam.
Yes, the official position is appeasing Muslim, giving them what they want and making peace between religions. Though almost all of the government elite are not Muslim, but Orthodox Christians. Christmas is even a state holiday. Mm. Well, Orthodox Christmas, the 7th of January.
Right.
Yes.
So I think what you're trying to get at is that while the official stance is of, you know, tolerance and acceptance, there is a sentiment within the population that isn't? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and there always has been.
So I'm having a hard time understanding it's fine. I'm not sure if I understand correctly. Are you saying basically it is prejudiced? Well, not racist because it's religion, but are you saying it is period anti-Muslim, or is it really a terrorist and extremist Islamism should be fought, and they are vehement about that? Or is it just they don't like Muslims?
All of that. There are strong, there are people with there are many people with strong opinions in all of these areas. There are
well, I guess that's the same story all over Europe and the world, but it's stronger in Russia, it seems.
It is stronger. When the things were hotter in Donetsk, there were camps in Moscow getting volunteers and money for them.
Okay.
To fight. So I guess those people might get doing some recruiting for other cause.
Okay.
Like fighting in Syria.
So that's actually something that, as I was saying, has been discussed in the sense that now we sort of need to try and help Assad, because there is no way we're going to be able to defeat ISIS without, you know, having support in the region, which of course is completely ironic because Assad was on the verge of being toppled a few years ago with the follow-up to the Arab Spring. Before we move on, Brian, is there any possibility that the U.S. would get involved in a war? You know, I don't know about sending troops, but some kind of retaliation in Syria and Iraq?
Well, I mean, we already have planes are doing missions against ISIS, flying out of Turkey and, you know, the Middle East there. I don't think they're flying out of Jordan, but Jordan is flying their own planes. You know, that's in the Middle East countries there, flying their own planes. I like the I kind of like the characterization of the Russian troops being volunteers, the volunteers who just happen to know how to fly Sukhoi 27s, MiG 29s, Sukhoi 25s, manned air defense batteries, you know.
We have military instructors there. I guess they teach Syrians to do the stuff.
Right. Yeah, they're not flying those planes. The Syrians are not flying those planes. I mean, they don't fly that.
How do you know? Have you seen the pilots' corpses?
Well, not yet.
Are you going to?
Well, I mean, so basically, if we were, Pierre, if we were to say, yeah, they're volunteers, wink, wink, and, you know, it's actually a, this is all being handled by the actual Russian army, which I think is not an uncommon sentiment in the West. Would you, as a Russian, say, oh, that's crap, that's Western propaganda, and these are actually volunteers? Would that be the sentiment that you would feel?
Well, as a Russian, I do strongly feel we might have regular troops there with special missions, as Brian said.
Okay.
But at least we are there in support of the official government.
Right. But you wouldn't be surprised if there was actually, in spite of the official line of we don't have any troops there doing missions, you wouldn't be surprised if there were actually troops. Would you?
No, I wouldn't. Okay. And I guess nobody would.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So it's not like, you know, this is the official word of the government and it is the truth. And, you know, this is what the truth comes out of Vladimir Putin's mouth and everyone believes it as such.
The official truth of the government is what has to be said politically. Mm-hmm. I guess everyone understands that nobody's here for good reasons. Every country is there for some sort of geopolitical reason, which cannot be usually morally judged.
Okay, that's interesting, actually. Okay, so anyway, Syria is still a mess, and this whole situation is a mess, and I guess there is no way of getting out of it in any dignified manner. So we'll see how it keeps evolving. Brian, let's move on to what everyone has actually been waiting for. Can you please, again, explain to us what the hell is happening in your country and in your party, in the Republican Party? What's this mess? And is it considered a mess, or is it just from Europe, you know, we just look at Trump and think, wow, that's a clown?
Yeah, you know, Trump is just, you know, he's going to do a great job. He is going to be number one on everything he does, and he's going to do it so fast to make your head spin. That's pretty much what he says about everything.
Okay. So. But yeah, so, but I mean, is he taken seriously in, it's very difficult to get a reading on how people actually approach the, you know, Trump as a political candidate. Is he amusing? Is he, you know,
people are taking him seriously. You have to take him seriously at this point, because he is leading the polls at 25%, which, I mean, it's very early. The first caucus in Iowa is not till February, so there's a lot of time in between. There will be more debates going on, so it is a little too early to kind of say, you know, the chicken's cooked. But he is. You have to take him seriously. I mean, whether you like him or you don't, I don't really care for him personally. I really don't even think he's a Republican, to be honest. But a lot of people do take him seriously. So just from that alone, you have to, have to address him, in a serious way. Whether he takes it seriously himself or not is the question, you know.
So, but I guess, again, we're not really close to it, so I'm not sure exactly how it's how serious this is. Like, it is a serious situation leading the polls. This is kind of an unbelievable situation for us, because some of the things he said, most notably, you know, the thing about Mexican immigrants who are rapists and whatever and come in this country and wreak havoc.
Yeah, he just kind of latches onto that issue. You know, he latched onto that issue. You know, there was a woman.
Sorry to interrupt, Brian, but I don't want to gloss over that thing, because it crystallizes the problem, not the problem, but the question that we all ask, which is, if someone was to say something like this in Europe, he would be immediately, you know, even our far right, more. Yeah, well, it's not even about it being hate speech. It's that no one could stand beside him in anywhere. Everyone would actually condemn him very firmly. And it's kind of a mystery that this is not happening in the U.S.
Well, a lot of people have condemned him for that. It's just, you know, he talks about building a wall. And, you know, I had been in the Border Patrol before. And so I'm pretty familiar with the immigration issue and everything. And the things that he talks about in regards to immigration to me aren't realistic. You can't build a wall all the way across. I mean, the fence, you know, better fence does work in certain areas, but you can't, it's not practical to do it all the way. I mean, there's just, you know, he says that stuff, and it just, what he's doing is just ginning up support, ginning up people's emotions regarding it, because it is an issue that people
But how is he getting it? How is he getting that support when he's saying such outrageous things, I guess, is my, the
he's
whole
tapped
thing
into
I
a
don't
certain
understand.
Anger. I think that this is what everybody's saying. He's tapped into a certain anger. There's a, you know, an undercurrent that and it's just not about immigration. That's a part of it, of course. But he's tapped into this anger and, you know, that people have been building up, you know, all these years under Obama. But I can also look at the Democrats and see there's something of that, too, with Bernie Sanders' support, you know, being higher than anyone thought it would be. So there's certain things, but you can already see, you know, Trump's support has started going down, the debates, you know, when they start talking about actual issues and getting into the weeds about, foreign policy. In the last debate, you know, when it came to discussing foreign affairs, he was silent for like 27 minutes in the debate. You know, I'm going to have the best administration, I'm going to have the best Secretary of State, and make your head spin. I mean, that's pretty much what he says about, you know, stuff that he doesn't know too much about. He just generalizes and, you know, uses superlatives.
So you think he's not going to, his support is not going to stay that high for when push comes to shove, and when the actual primaries start, you think his numbers are going to start going down because people are going to start thinking seriously about the issue or about the election?
Yeah, I think there's an amusement factor right now. You know, we don't have to get too serious about it right now, but when it starts coming, getting to it, I mean, I think there will still be people that will, you know, be for him. But I think in the most part, like, you know, people, most of my friends that I know, you know, like, they're amused by him. Find it interesting. And the one positive I can say is that he has increased our awareness. You know, he has brought the spotlight onto the race. I mean, you just can't deny that he's brought a lot of attention to it. And, you know, because at this point, like last time, there was scant attention paid. But now everybody is talking about it. Everybody, you know, even on both sides, Republicans and Democrats are a lot more interested and a lot more into it than they were the last cycle.
So it takes a clown to bring attention to the election, and now ultimately it might be a good thing, maybe?
He is a promoter. I mean, I like to equate him to Henry Hill from The Music Man. You know, I'm just, he's like that consummate kind of con man coming in there, you know, getting everybody riled up. We're going to build a band, when it comes down to it, it's like, I think he'll be like, oh, this is a little bit more than I thought it would be.
So you mentioned in passing Bernie Sanders, which I just want to address quickly. Looking at him from here, he seems like the most grounded, realistic politician there is. And you know, taking issues, looking at what works, which is something that I don't think politicians do a lot, looking at what works everywhere and trying to apply lessons from what he's learned in a very practical, non-politician way. And I'm surprised that he is not being regarded as more of a genuine candidate and more of as a, you know, the outsider, the previously independent guy who, yeah, he doesn't really have any chance. And, you know, now he's higher in the polls than would have been expected. So people are paying attention to him.
I take him a lot more serious than I take Trump. Bernie has been a senator for a while. I don't agree with much that he says, but I've watched a couple of town hall that before he got involved into the race. I've watched a couple of town hall meetings he's had, and he is a plain spoken guy, and he's sincere. And I think he's a sincere guy. I mean, he believes this stuff that he says, and I think that comes over, and I think that's why a lot of Democrats have gravitated toward. And to be honest, I don't sense any enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's in trouble right now with the email scandal. And to be honest, I don't think she's going to make it to the race. Yeah, I don't think, not considering, like I said, when I was in the Army, I was in intelligence when I was in the Army, and I had a top secret clearance, and the stuff that she did in regards to classified information, I would have been in jail. I'd have been 10 years in prison, and Fort Leavenworth, for me, if I had done that. And
so you mean her using her personal email to communicate classified information?
Correct. Yeah, there's a whole strata of things that you have to know, and even if they say, oh, well, it wasn't marked. Well, it doesn't matter. A lot of times, if it's marked, you have to know that information is classified. You need to recognize that it's classified and secure it. When she didn't do that, and her aides didn't do that, her lawyers, it's going to be, I think it's going to be a lot more involved when you get down to it. But the FBI is going to take their time, and it's going to be a few months, but I think before we actually get anything from it.
Isn't it a capital offense in states?
No, but the thing is that just like they've confirmed two of the emails she had top secret information. And that's really serious. The agencies that generated that information say they were top secret from the get-go. They were top secret code word. And that's, like I said, that you disseminating that, or that's each offense is 10 years, $10,000 fine. That's the way I had signed many forms. I had to go to briefings, and every time you go somewhere, they brief you. It's a big deal, when you're in that community,
It's actually, I think, well, some of what comes out of this is, well, she's not going to go in prison. I think I would be very surprised if she did. And it's kind of those politicians are all fake and privileged and all of this. And what comes pretty, strongly from both Trump and from Sanders as in very different ways is that they are, what you were saying, they're genuine. You know, they're not embarrassed by the political, you know, correctness, and they're actual people, for good or for bad. I would say for good for Sanders, and for extravagance for Trump, he just says it just the way it is. Maybe that is what is making them so popular, and maybe that's something that the actual politicians should take a lesson from.
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's that kind of, and a lot of people say that about Trump. Oh, he's not PC. He says what he's saying. And same thing with Sanders. Sanders is, you know, he's an independent. He's not even like a member. He's not even the Democrat Party. He's an independent. He's running as a Democrat, but he's always had his independent voice. That's one thing I can say for Bernie. You know, I've kept, you know, I always knew who he was. You know, I'm interested in politics, and that's the guy. You know, you can go look back videos of his town hall meetings with his constituents, and that's the guy.
And he goes to work on the public transportation, and you know, all of those silly little stories that I think now bear weight because all of the others feel there's definitely disenfranchisation with politics, and I think in Europe as well. There's so for all of them, and I think it's always been true. Of that, they're politicians, they lie through their teeth, and they're, you know, they're fake and whatever. But it hasn't been as true as it is today. And that might be why the far-right parties are rising everywhere in Europe, is because it feels like it might be because they're at least saying something. You're not sitting through, like, hours of babbling that doesn't mean anything, that is just political speak.
How's Marine Le Pen doing? She had a little blowout with her dad recently, didn't she?
Yeah, that's kind of ridiculous. As you were saying, basically the dad, who was the founder of the far right party, the National Front in France, was ousted from the party he founded by his daughter, and he wanted to found another party, and it was a complete implosion. I mean, I don't think ultimately the elections are far away enough that she's still going to be very strong. But she personifies that sentiment as well. Although I will say that, you know, she would never say something as outrageous as Trump would. Never. She would be laughed out of the country if she said something like that. She is definitely far right, and she talks about, you know, what we can do for French people and the country, and like in a way that is nationalistic for sure, but she would never say anything as outrageous as what Trump says.
Yeah, so. Trump's a showman. I mean, he had a TV show. He's a living reality show.
What is that making any noise, Pierre, in Russia? Is Trump, you know, making the headlines in Moscow?
Sometimes he does. The last time I've seen a line about him was that he was raped to death in South Park.
Ah, I haven't seen that South Park episode. But,
yes, he was.
I've heard about it. Is that how, I mean, free speech, that's, you know, if you can't fault America for not having free speech, but I guess, yeah, they make fun of everyone on South Park. So, so he's not, he does come around in Russia, but it's not like.
Yes, he does come around. And of course, who gonna be the president of our archenemy is most important to us.
How serious is that joke of our archenemy?
Well,
32%.
It is pretty serious in a huge chunk of the population, actually, like something like 80%. Well, some say it less seriously, but we do not like when we are being schooled by other countries. We do not like when we are being told what to do by other countries. I guess most countries don't like that. And when the Europe with America on the front lines are trying to tell us what we should do and what we shouldn't, and trying to punish us for what we are doing and stuff like that, what is it? Kindergarten?
I guess, yeah. That is a sentiment that I'm feeling more and more as I learn more about Russia. It's the Russian pride is incredibly strong, and it's perfectly okay for, well, it's okay for, that's my sentiment, tell me if I'm wrong, Pierre, but it's okay for a Russian to criticize Russia, but if someone from outside of the country says something about Russia, then everyone turns around at the same time and goes like, who the hell do you think you are? In Russian. Mm. Is that a fair characterization?
Almost. It's okay if others say stuff about us, as long as they respect us and do not act without that respect.
I think the definition of respect in different cultures might have been the reason
the issue
for more. Yeah, exactly. That's probably the starting the factor that has started the most wars in the history of the world. All right. Very quickly, you wanted to mention something that I'm curious about. There's a national debate apparently in Russia about the possibility of raising the minimum age.
It's not a national debate. Russia is and always has been a fairly drinking country, mostly because of the cold.
It's the same in Finland, yeah. I can understand that.
Yes. So there is an act from the Communist Party to raise the allowed age to buy alcohol.
Sorry, very quick side question. How popular is the Communist Party in Russia now?
It holds something like 10% of the 10% of the parliament.
Okay, that's not bad, but it's not.
It's popular with the old people.
pretty incredible. In all of Eastern Europe, there are so many people who are nostalgic of the communist era. It's very strange. But anyway, sorry, keep going.
They forget about the bread lines.
Yeah, exactly.
Gorbachev is pretty much hated by all the not only the old people.
Why do they hate Gorbachev?
Oh, lots of reasons. The most common line is that he split the Soviet Union. He broke it.
Ah.
But there were many reasons. It is said that he was too much under his wife's wing, that he tried to cover up the Chernobyl story. Right after the Chernobyl, he has ordered for the 1st of May demonstrations. It's a parade where people go to the streets because the 1st of May is the day, is the workers' day.
Yeah. Labor Day.
Yeah, Labor Day, sorry. His own wife led children from Chernobyl schools on the demonstration. Nobody was evacuated at first. They tried to hush it up. It's also an issue with the people who heard it and saw it.
That's funny. And I think in the West, Gorbachev is regarded as the person who started the opening of the Soviet Union and the breaking up of the Eastern Bloc, but
he's regarded as the Western pawn in that issue.
The Western porn? What do you mean by
porn? Porn.
Oh, porn. Okay. All right. Okay. So let's go back to the alcohol thing. So you want to raise the minimum age?
Yeah, they want to raise the minimum age. They claim they're thinking about children, their purity, that they're not yet developed when they're 18 and they are developed when they are 21, as they think, or something like that. Well, it is a healthy position, but then they should have raised the conscription, the minimum conscription age to the army.
We have
mandatory 1 year of army service when we are 18. And that age is not being raised.
Yeah, I think it's an issue everywhere.
Yeah, we're children enough not to buy alcohol, but we are not children already, so we can go fight or something.
And so, okay, so it's just for health reasons. I had heard something about the price of alcohol being so low that people were getting drunk. That the economy was so low that they wanted to lower the price of alcohol so people could get drunk. Is that some kind of an urban legend?
I guess it is an urban legend or an anecdote. The price of alcohol for people who want to get drunk and don't care much about what they drink is quite low.
Already.
It's about 50 rubles for a bottle of vodka, or maybe less. Mm. 50 rubles, for those who do not know, now amounts to something like 80 cents, American cents.
Wow, that's cheap liquor. All right, Brian, do you want to talk about Uber finally getting in Vegas? For those who don't know, you live in Las Vegas, and there's a extraordinary taxi lobby in Vegas that fought Uber tooth and nail, right?
Yes, that's correct. Our state legislature meets every other year, and they just had their session and ended in June this year, and they passed a law right before they left that allowed for the ride-sharing programs like Lyft and Uber to be legal. And starting this month, Uber and Lyft started operations, but our county here said they wouldn't issue them their county business licenses because they're not prepared yet to do that. And it's just really kind of a political thing that the taxi lobby is. You know, they want to delay Uber and Lyft as much as they can here. The thing in Vegas is that taxi drivers are not well liked by the locals here because they operate on the hotels and they never pick up locals. It's very difficult to get a taxi here if you're a local.
Oh, that's why.
Oh, yeah. They hate. We do not like them because if you know your car breaks down or something, if you need to get a taxi, you need to call at least an hour ahead of time. You're going to be waiting well over an hour, and there's many taxis, and they get mad at you. Like if you go onto the strip and see a show, maybe you had a little too much to drink, you want to get a cab home. A lot of cabbies, they do not like that, and some will not take you. Because they want to get the quick fares on the strip, and
they don't want to take you back out of the strip. Yeah, okay.
Right. Because they, you know, they'll be gone a while and they'll lose money the way they see it, and they also rip off tourists a lot. There's this route they take from the airport called, and it goes underneath the runway, and they long haul people, and it's been going on for years. So a lot of locals like myself just pretty much say, well, you guys kind of had it coming. You know, there's no sympathy, you know, at least now Uber, you know, you have, especially like with senior citizens or something like that, they need a ride to the doctor. Uber's going to be good for them. You know, I think and it's going to be an overall positive for our community.
You know, it's something that Las Vegas and Paris can have in common now, our dislike for taxis and our love for Uber, in spite of regulations and lobbies.
Yeah, I've been keeping up on the Paris story. That's been in the Wall Street Journal. They've been keeping up on that story about how how Uber's going. And like I said, the county here has fined Uber drivers and Lyft drivers for picking up at the airport. But Uber says, oh, we'll pay all the fines.
there's a little bit of that for sure. Uber being cocky and just asking, doing things and asking for forgiveness or permission afterwards. But it's been working out for them. I mean, certainly there are things that are, let's say, unsavory, but...
Well, they got pretty serious with Uber in Paris, haven't they? They brought those two execs in and, you know, read them the Riot Act. We're going to jail them, and it's like, wow.
Yeah, they're going on trial fairly soon. It's very serious, very serious. But that's the power of the taxi lobbies for you. Also, the fact that you know, well, it's a whole discussion. But I think the problem is there is a real demand for that kind of service. And the question isn't, is it going to disappear? You know, can they squash it? Because they can't. If they squash that one, it will reappear in another form. But the big question now is, can they make it so it becomes well integrated administratively and that they are taxed as they should be so that the state sees, you know, the green from that business as they would expect to. That's something they've been doing with Airbnb, and they, for a bunch of reasons, it's a different business, but they've been finding agreements with Airbnb and it's working out. But with Uber, it's a much bigger conversation. But I think hopefully they're realizing that this is not going to go away. Uber or services like it is here to stay, and they have to deal with that or they will be left behind. So, Yeah,
I think the genie's out of the bottle on that. I think Uber and Lyft, they've proved that there's a demand for it, and I think there is. Yeah. And there's at least niche markets that haven't been served by taxis, and you know, I can envision a whole, you know, that they could both work together, you know, they could both coexist, I should say.
Yeah.
But it's too late.
Exactly. It's like, you know, I liken it to music sharing on the internet a little bit. I remember when the music industry squashed Napster in the early 2000s. They thought they had won. They were like, yes, now Napster's gone, problem solved. We dodged that bullet. And of course, the music sharing came back and illegal downloading came back until they finally addressed the root of the issue, which was that need, and technology made these things possible. So they had to make it work with those new needs that had been created. And it seems like it's the same issue here with Uber. Ultimately, there's something that is rendered possible because the situation has changed, and trying to get those many cats back in the bag is not going to work out. So,
no, I think that's a good analogy with the music industry. They shut down Napster, thought they won, and then Steve Jobs came in and started up iTunes, and they're like, what? You know?
Well, no, I think, no, it was even before that. They started again with Emule and Genutella and all of those. And that's when, you know, when Steve Jobs arrived, he was like, all right, listen, everyone's stealing music. Do you want to try and sell some at least? And like, yes, please. And that's,
well,
you know,
that was on the back of the iPod too. So yeah, he was driving it from both ends.
Yeah.
So he, you know.
Yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. You mean with, yeah, of course.
So they could have, the record industry, they could have just said, they could have bought Napster and said, hey, we're going to charge 99 cents. And they'd be, you know, sitting pretty now. But, yeah. You know.
Oh, you could have, what you're saying is that the taxi lobbies should buy Uber. I get it.
Yeah.
Well, it would cost them a lot of money.
Too much now. Yeah.
Yeah. Is Uber and ride sharing a thing in Russia, Pierre, or is it did it not make it there?
I don't even know what it is.
Oh my God! You don't?
No, I don't.
The
we
app.
We still have common taxes right here.
Are you seriously? You don't know what Uber is?
Well, I can check the Russian Google store. Play market.
No, I mean it's basically an app that lets you call a car, which is kind of like a taxi, but it's usually nicer cars and it's drivers driving around. It's like taxis, except you call them with an app. And the big contention comes from the fact that most cities have permits for taxis, and those Uber cars don't have those permits because they're not technically taxis. They're just cars that you reserve in advance, except with the app, you can reserve them when you need it, and they're going to come to your place. So that in advance portion effectively disappears. And so that's why it's more practical than taxis, but they're not actually taxis. And the taxis are obviously angry because their permits are very expensive to pay. So they have competition from people who are don't have to pay the permits and the licenses, but are at least as efficient as the taxis, and usually a lot nicer. You have the follow the route you took that's recorded and sent to you, and they come and open the door for you. They have, you know, they wear a suit. Their cars are super nice. So yeah, that's what Uber is. So you don't have that?
Well, I see it and some Russian reviews in Play Market, but since I haven't heard of it, it's not that popular.
Yeah, that's surprising, because it's basically, if it was very, you know, if it was being used in the same way that it is in the West, you would have heard about it, because it's one of the main issues in the news for a year. It's been coming back every so often. So yeah, that's interesting. Maybe they haven't officially launched in Russia yet, but all right, I think that is going to be it for our show. Thank you very much, guys, for being on.
Thank you for having me.
I will ask both of you if you have something to promote on the web. Do you have a Twitter account? Do you have something you want to let our listeners know about? Let's start with Brian.
No, you're not
on Twitter, Brian?
I am on Twitter. You know I'm on Twitter.
I know. But okay, it's just Brian, the conservative guy from Vegas.
Pretty much it.
And Pierre, do you have a Twitter account? I mean, I know you do.
Yes, I do have a Twitter account at Lisa, TYLWESA. But I don't write much in it.
That's so sad.
Since the last time I have started doing it in English. But still not much to write about.
All right. Yeah, I see. I just went to your Twitter account and I see that the last one was from September 23rd and the one before August 10. So yeah, not a lot. Get on Twitter. Twitter is cool. And for me, it's not Patrick on Twitter, not Patrick on Facebook. And I was talking about the fact that I wanted to do those special episodes. People who are patrons of the show, first of all, thank you so much. It's at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. And I have one of the goals on the Patreon, which was to do special episodes once a quarter. And I think we haven't reached the goal yet, but I think I want to start doing those special episodes at least once a quarter, maybe even more, to get one person and a one-on-one discussion to try and find out more about the way they live, what they do, their country, their culture. And I think I'm going to try and start this series with our good friend Turkey, who isn't here on the show today. But I actually met for the first time a few days ago. He was in Paris with his lovely wife, and we have been, you know, doing shows together for, I don't know, at least 5 years, and we had never met. And it was such an awesome emotional moment to actually meet him. It was very, very nice. He was, of course, as obnoxious in real life as he is on the show, which I enjoyed. So we discussed it, and I think I'm going to be doing that first special episode with him. Hopefully it will be out in September. That's the plan anyway. So I'll keep doing that. I think the show, The Phileas Club, deserves a little bit more attention than I had been giving it until now, for, you know, a bunch of reasons. I was starting as a podcaster and it wasn't easy, but now I'm sort of in the rhythm of things. So I want to try and do a little bit more with this show. Hopefully you will enjoy this, dear listeners. And of course, if you want to support the show, patreon.com/thephileasclub. You can comment on the show on frenchspin.com, which is the site where I host all of my shows I do in English. And of course, Twitter, not Patrick. You can come and tell us what you thought of this episode there as well. Again, thank you so much to Brian and to Pierre for having been on this East versus West episode. There wasn't nearly as much fighting and arguing as I would have hoped, but, you know, it will have to do. And either way,
we can keep going, you know, turn it up a notch if you like.
Yeah, let's try it and rile things up a little bit. Let's talk about what should we talk about? Spying.
The Ukraine.
Yeah, let's do that. All right, maybe next time. So anyway, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with a regular episode in a month, and hopefully with a special one before that. Talk to you then, and have a good time. Hug people you love. It was my birthday, and that was my request for my birthday about 5 days ago. Hug people you love is what I say. Bye, everyone.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.